Well, good morning to everyone, and welcome to familiar faces and new faces, and happy to have you here. I am going to see if I can just, there we go. I just wanted to share the sixth picture. Everybody can see it, I hope. Thumbs up. Mounting the bull slowly, I return homeward. The voice of my flute intones through the evening, measuring with hand beats the pulsating harmony. I direct the endless rhythm. Whoever hears this melody will join me, riding home on the ox. So as we've talked before, each of us who leads the Sunday morning, we're just sharing our own perspectives on these ox herding pictures. And a lot of you will have some different views. But these are my reflections. After Lauren's talk last Sunday, I reflected more on the whole journey that we in the ox herder have been taking since January. The journey of first beginning to realize that there is something to seek, that there was something missing or askew in our lives. And then we discovered a footprint. And for me, the footprint might have been a talk or a book on the spiritual path or going to a retreat or a day long. Something sparked us to keep looking. Even when in the third picture, when we first saw that ox, that enormous hind end, it didn't dissuade us. The wholesome desire, even if we weren't quite sure what we were describing, what the desire was, seemed worth the effort. And after that first glimpse of the ox, whether we call it the mind or our true nature or the path to freedom, we moved on to pictures 4 and 5. The ox herder sees what she has only previously imagined. She starts using the whip and the rope to try to control the ox. And then, having been somewhat successful, we're shown a picture of a seemingly calmed ox in picture 5. And then, in my view, abracadabra, she's sitting on the back of the ox, holding on to nothing and playing the flute. I've shared before that I have kind of a skeptical mind. I see the ox herder falling off of the ox, hopefully not damaging herself in the flute, but realizing that there's more work to be done before the ease and confidence that picture 6 talks about. In my talk a couple weeks ago, which was on the fifth picture, I said that I thought we needed some more pictures between the fourth and the sixth. In that talk, I encouraged us to reflect on the first noble truth, the truth of acknowledging dukkha, of fully experiencing it, and then integrating it into the knowledge and life in our daily lives. Dukkha is also one of the three characteristics. And so this morning, I'm going to talk some about the other two, anicca, which is impermanence, and anatta, which is not self. This is the work, this part of the practice that I believe needs to be attended to before we can actually stay on the back of the ox playing our flute. By this time in our practice, we've seen over and over again the truth of impermanence. All the body sensations that come and go. It's like Lauren's instructions to us this morning. You know, we notice all those changes, that itch that was so uncomfortable for what seemed hours, but in reality was just a few minutes, and then it was gone. All the thoughts and opinions and moods and mind states that appear seemingly out of nowhere, and they stay around for a while, sometimes a long while, but then they fade away. They fade away when we don't attach to them and make them into something that we believe is real and our own. We've had that wonderful reflection and awareness of when there was this grumpy, overly critical, everything and everybody is wrong kind of mood, that maybe permeated an entire day, and then the next day you wake up and that mood is gone. That awareness, that clear seeing, is really connecting to the truth of impermanence, the truth of anicca. It's so essential to our practice. And yet many of us still have our list of exceptions to that truth, the parts of our lives that we cling to just knowing that they'll stay the same, or the people in our lives whose ongoing presence is just taken for granted. I've shared recently in our drop-in sits that my older brother Bob recently had a very bad fall, which caused a brain injury. And not only did the accident and knowing he was hurt upset me, but I realized he was on that exception list. It really threw me. You know, he's the person still alive who's known me longer than anyone else. And I just really hadn't considered that he could die or be severely diminished. A friend recently reminded me that this kind of thing, that it happens, is when impermanence really hits us in the face. I'm sure many of us have had that same kind of experience. So many of us have done a lot of practice, both sitting and in daily life, deepening our understanding of impermanence. And we remember the gifts that the Buddha received that started him on the path, the gifts of aging, of illness and death. And yet, even with our deepening understanding of change, how we will become separate from everything and everyone we hold dear, we find ourselves still clinging to whatever identity is present at the moment, believing ourselves to be a continuous, solid, and substantial self. In the Buddha's instructions to his son Rahula, he said, "Rahula, any form whatsoever that is past, future, or present, internal or external, blatant or subtle, common or sublime, far or near, every form is to be seen as it actually is with right discernment, as this is not mine, this is not myself, this is not what I am." In these pictures, the ox herder has taken on one identity after another. Searcher, finder, one who is seeing, catcher, tamer, rider, and flute player. If we just taking the identities from the titles of each of the pictures, we can also see them more metaphorically as one who knows dissatisfaction, one who is hunting for happiness, one who believes she's found the way to happiness through the ox and whip and the rope, one who believes she has tamed the ox and who's sitting pretty on top of the world. And has she left any of those earlier identities behind? Has she brought them all with her and that they show up at different times? What's her relationship to all these identities? And so what is our relationship with all of the identities that we cling to, both in daily life and as we sit in meditation? Most of us have, you know, we've heard Dharma talks on anatta in the past. So what I'm sharing and going to continue to share is going to sound pretty familiar. And yet we remember that letting go of a sense of a continuous, solid, substantial self is often considered to be the very last letting go that happens before awakening. So it's super important. And I think talking about anatta once again is a good thing to be doing. I don't presume to be any kind of expert on this. Like many of you, you know, I've worked with various exercises and approaches to deepening my understanding of not self. The exercise that many of us have learned from Joseph Goldstein's talks, where he suggests that we turn am into is, as in, I am angry, I am sad, I am restless, into anger is present, sadness is present, restlessness is present. And that kind of exercise can take a lot of the emotional attachment out of a mood or mind state that is disturbing. And even though I've done a lot of work with that, I've noticed that I'm less inclined to do the am to is when I'm happy, enthusiastic, or feeling really positive states, I want to keep all of those as mine. Over the years, I've really appreciated the way Christina Feldman teaches about anatta. She uses that, she turns it into a verb of selfing. I'm very familiar with the process of selfing, and I think it's an important part of our practice as we reflect on this, these pictures, and they describe the path of awakening, how much working with this process of selfing is really an essential element in our paths towards freedom. So I notice how much I cling to the various identities that I claim. There's strong emotions arise when I live in a neighborhood right near Fremont, and if I say to people, oh yeah, I'm Pete's mom, he's very well known in the neighborhood, and I get instant status, you know, so I have an identity as somebody else's mother, and it gives me some sense of importance. Or I get that sense of kind of pride and identity when I'm acknowledged as the owner of this property where my village is. I've seen on meditation retreats and as a Dhamma student that I, especially if the, you know, the sits are going really well and I can get quite a sense of self-importance as this really good meditator, even when there are times when I'm lost in thought and unaware of what is happening. And then, of course, you know, on these Sunday mornings when I take the virtual Dhamma seat and share what I know of the topic, you know, what I feel that all those different emotions about this identity as someone who is sharing the Dhamma. And I know and experience how the emotions and thoughts that accompany the presence of these identities reinforce a sense of ownership and constancy that in reality don't exist. Self is a concept, and we create that concept over and over and over again. Just as everything that has the nature to arise will fall away, so will this sense of me and mine and I am, especially if we don't cling to it. So this part of the practice, investigating and fully seeing how selfing lives and thrives in our lives, it's humbling and sometimes confusing part of the practice. We cling so automatically to these identities. The ownership arises so quickly that it takes really our best mindfulness to notice what is happening. Later on, I just this morning looked at the seventh picture, which is all about selfing. So I was thinking, oh, maybe I'm giving my talk too soon. But I think that this issue is going to keep coming up in our practice. It's such an essential element. So this morning, I want us all to reflect on how much selfing and identification has already taken place in these first six pictures. By the sixth picture, the ox herder is looking pretty confident, even a bit haughty. Not only is she sitting on the back of the ox with nothing to hold on to, but she's also playing the flute. You know, it's kind of like, look what I've done. I went on a search, found the ox, used my tools that I brought, and tamed him. And then I'm sitting here, you know, sitting pretty in life. And, you know, have you ever had those kinds of thoughts about your practice? Like, and where you are on the path, filled with a sense of real appreciation for an insight that has come up, or having been on retreat and it was a really, what we would call a really good retreat. There was a lot of concentration and insights. And then what kind of identity came up around that? Oh, what a good yogi I am, you know, or you might have felt a lot the opposite, you know, filled with a lot of doubts about yourself as a meditator and whether you're ever going to find concentration, and then proclaimed yourself to be a bad yogi, taking that form of identity, clinging to what sometimes that's called kind of an imposter syndrome. You know, one of our guiding teachers, Tim Guile, has reminded us about there's the navigational self, you know, which is really useful. It's essential in our lives. It's the self that helps us get our work done, take care of business, you know, get the laundry done, go to work, make money, do all the things that we need to do. But it's this other sense of self that we create over and over and over again, and we cling to it, and that's where we get into trouble. Last week, Lauren shared the way that Tim suggests we can group these 10 pictures and stories into four categories: search, struggle for mastery, letting go, and integration. At this juncture of the whole set of pictures, I think we're caught in and finding our way through the two middle categories, struggle for mastery and letting go. Part of the struggle for mastery is identifying and seeing what there is to let go of. And it seems to me that one of the biggest things that we need to let go of is the identity of the one who has seen, tamed, and controlled the ox. Again, last Sunday, I keep quoting Lauren, which I love that I feel like my talk is a continuation of hers. Lauren said, "We have nothing to hold on to, including who we think we are." So who have we thought we were during these first months, during these first phases of the path? We know that stepping onto this path and bringing the commitment to practice isn't an easy thing to do. Of course, there are moments of ease and calm and even times of a real sense of bliss. But then there are many, many moments, once the mind has kind of stopped its chatter, that the truth of the way things are rises up into awareness. And those aren't easy moments. Eventually, for me, gratitude for the practice comes up that it has allowed me to see the truth. But before the gratitude, there's a lot of discomfort. And much of that discomfort comes from clinging to views of who I think I am, who is experiencing this discomfort, clinging to my desire for things to be different than they are, clinging to beliefs about who I am, what I can control, what I can't. So I've been quoting Lauren a lot this morning. And I really liked one of the things she shared last week, where she brought back in our study of dependent origination, which we did 2 years ago, and applied it to these four groupings of the ox herding stories. She said that integration doesn't happen unless we first let go. Letting go doesn't happen unless we are diligent and disciplined towards mastery. Mastery doesn't happen unless we continue on the search. And I would add that mastery and letting go doesn't happen unless we also bring along the understanding of the three characteristics of dukkha, anicca, and anatta. Selfing and the clinging to views of who we think we are and how life is happening to me and all the ways we take ownership is dukkha. Guy Armstrong describes this as bondage. He says, "This is the bondage of the past, bondage to our own choices, our own karma." To free ourselves from this bondage, we need to fully explore this bigger understanding of self, not the navigational self, this self that we create over and over again and cling to. It's not a quick process, as any of you here who've been sitting for a long time will testify to. It takes time, maybe lifetimes. Utijaniya, you know, has those daily meditations that you can sign up for. And in a recent post, he said, "There's no shortcut to enlightenment. Improving the quality of your mind is like growing a new business, not like winning the lottery." Any of you here who are business people like I am, I was really struck by that, because it's a long process. It takes a lot of diligence and a lot of self-honesty about what works and what doesn't. So offering these thoughts on selfing and impermanence. I'm hoping that this will stimulate some of your own reflections on where we are in this process, these first 6 months of the description that 12th century Chinese monk developed when he did these pictures and the commentary, you know, about what the path is all about. I'd like to close with this quote that I've always loved from Joseph Goldstein's teacher, Manindraji, who said that it's not that the self isn't real. It's just that it's not really real. So for our breakout groups this morning, I'd like to invite you all to share your own reflections on selfing and how it shows up on your path, your practice of realizing the Dhamma, your practice towards freedom and awakening, how it shows up in your daily life, any things that you've learned about it and ways that you've been able to maybe loosen a little bit of the grip on some of these identities. So thank you very much for your attention. And let's just take a moment of quiet and let my words and my encouragement to you all just kind of settle. So we're going to have time now for breakout groups. Welcome back, everybody. And we've got time for any sharing on topic or not. Makes no difference. Whatever's up for anyone. It's always such a nice time to hear what's happening for people. So anything anyone wants to share from their group or just any thoughts. And I think you have permission to just unmute yourself. So you could probably do that as opposed to, if you want to raise a hand, you can. But that's in that little reactions button. Lauren, did you want to say something?
Well, I was just checking to see if I could unmute myself and if I had allowed other people to unmute themselves. And so I'm assuming they can. And I will just say that I thought the topic of anatta, selfing, I think that's why there are so many pictures ahead of us, because it takes so much to separate the self that and then we're still the self, if you know. I mean, in a way, there's a certain selfhood left at the very end with the person going back into the marketplace, but that separation of like self-image, I just find that one of the worst dukkha things that I have to deal with, is finding myself having this self-image and then thinking, oh, is it damaged, you know, and what are they thinking of me, and what if I'm not that thing I thought I was, you know, that it's just, and then to go to like death, you know, to that part, the body, and that being in touch with this body is really not anything to identify with either. So to me, it seems like definitely the flutist on top of the ox appear, you know, the picture looks like he's on top of the world, you know, or she is really, everything's hunky-dory, you know. But there is still so much to go to really get to awakening. And it, has mostly to do with the separation of the self, I think, because it's just so hard to let go of that. So I just thought you opened up a kettle of worms or something. A can of worms.
Some worms box or whatever.
Yep. Yeah.
And yet, you know, we've all, every time you go on retreat, there's going to be some talk on it. We've all heard this a lot. Mm-hmm. And it's because we have to keep going back to it. Mm-hmm. The subtlety of it. Sometimes we think, oh, I've made progress here. And then something happens and just hits you in the face. And that me, and this is about me, and all of that. Thanks, Lauren. Mm-hmm. And thanks for reminding us. I don't know if everybody looks ahead for the 7 through 10 pictures. But that yeah, you're right. That's kind of where we're going. Anyone else? Charlotte and then Lillian.
Oh, yes. Good. Well, we talked about kindness to ourselves and being aware of our challenges, but trying to be compassionate towards our struggles. Thank you.
Yeah. Such an important reminder, since it's so easy to add more judgment and criticism and aren't I awful when you're already feeling bad from the other stuff. Yeah, thanks, Charlotte. Lillian.
Yeah, with the three principles, so the second two were impermanence and then non-self. What is the first one?
Dukkha.
And what does that stand for?
The unsatisfactoriness of life, which often you recognize because life, things arise and pass away. Anything that has the nature to arise will pass away. And yet we cling to things thinking that they'll offer some permanent satisfaction or happiness, and they don't. And then that causes the dukkha. It's kind of a shorthanded way of describing the dukkha, but you know, watching how we look for satisfaction and happiness in arenas that don't last, whether it's always, you know, like being unhappy because I can no longer do some of the yoga poses I used to do, and being mad about that, you know, well, bodies change. And or, you know, the list is almost endless in a way, you know, of the things that we believe are going to bring that sense of happiness. And often I think the reason why the four foundations spend so much time on the body is because the body is such a good teacher of that what we were able to do or how we looked or the size, whatever, some size pants that we used to get into and no longer get into, you know, whatever the different changes in the body that we resist and believe that, you know, are constant, and then they're not. And the same thing with emotions, you know, that when we take on, we put labels on ourselves, an emotional label, because we often have felt this, but do we always feel that? Is it a constant in our lives? So is that how we then create an identity around, I'm always happy. Well, except for the times that I'm not, you know, or I never get angry except for the time I just blew up at my partner, you know, or those identities that we create. Sorry, I went on longer than I should have, William, but yeah.
Thank you. Yeah, I enjoyed hearing about this today.
Yes, Claire, please.
The little sign I have posted on my computer, I think, is what you're saying. It's not perfect. It's not permanent. It's not personal.
Yeah. I love that way of taking the three characteristics and putting them into that language. I think I first heard that from Bonnie Duran, who's a local Dharma teacher in Seattle. And yeah, I think that's really helpful. Everybody else is good with this? Just a reminder, well, actually, Lauren's going to say that, but I'm going to say it also, that on July 24th, there will not be a Sunday sit, because 24th, because of the ayahs that are going to be here that afternoon. So, and I'm going to turn it over to Lauren, and she can give our announcements and ending. And thanks, everybody, for participating and being part of the Sangha.
So now we'll just take a moment to close with an offering of metta, which was brought up in our discussion, and we don't want to forget our heart, and we don't want to forget the Brahma Viharas of kindness, compassion, joy, and equanimity. Being in touch with those divine abodes inside ourselves and in the way we connect with others. So may we all feel compassion for ourselves and for all the beings that are living with dukkha. May the practice that we had this morning together benefit all. And as we said in our opening, which I really love, freeing our minds of greed, hatred, and delusion through this practice offers the opportunity for others to do the same and reduces ignorance and hatred in the world. I love that. So thank you, everyone.